You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On February 21st, 1992, 22-year-old Brian Bechtold walked into a police station in Port St. Joe, Florida, and confessed that he'd shot and killed his parents in their family home in Silver Spring, Maryland. He said he'd been possessed by the devil. He was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia and ruled not criminally responsible for the murders on grounds of insanity. But after the trial, where did the criminally insane go? Makita Brotman reveals Brian's inner life leading up to the murder, as well as his complicated afterlife in a maximum security psychiatric hospital, where he is neither imprisoned nor free. During his 27 years at the hospital, Brian has tried to escape and been shot by police, and has witnessed three patient-on-patient murders. He's experienced the drugging of patients beyond recognition, a sadistic system of rewards and punishments, and the short-lived reign of a crazed psychiatrist turned stalker. In the tradition of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Couple Found Slain is an insider's account of life in the underworld of forensic psych wards in America and the forgotten lives of those held there, often indefinitely. The book that we're featuring this evening is Couple Found Slain, After a Family Murder, with my special guest, author and psychoanalyst, Makita Brotman. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Makita Brotman.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. This is an extraordinary book, as I mentioned to you, especially in regard to its uniqueness. Let's tell our audience how you came to be the author, why you wanted to write this book, how you became to be the author of Couple Found Slain.
Well, I'm glad that you think it's unique, because that's really what I was going for. And to tell you about how I came to write it, I really need to say a little bit about my own interest in true crime, which has always been an interest of mine. But I'm not so interested in like genre true crime. I'm much more interested in the stories that don't get told. So the stories sort of around the periphery of the actual crime itself. And
right,
that's something that's interested me for a while. And in 2013, my ordinary day job as a professor at a college, and I was on sabbatical that year, and I did some volunteer teaching. I taught in a prison, and I taught in a forensic psychiatric hospital called Clifton Perkins in Maryland, and I taught fiction. So the group in Perkins, the psychiatric hospital, was for pretty high-functioning patients to help them to have discussion groups, to read, to help develop empathy and so on, and to help just an activity, give them something to do. So Brian was one of the members of the group right from the start, and I was, they were all, and this is a maximum security facility, so all the patients have committed serious crime, but I was surprised how high-functioning they were. But Brian in particular, because he was eager to join in, he was very helpful, he was articulate, he was genial, he was interesting. And I started to wonder, I didn't know what the patients had done or what their diagnoses were, but I started to wonder about Brian and, you know, what he was doing there. And then one day after another patient had left, a young girl, we were talking about her, and Brian said that he wanted to ask her out, but then he found that she was born in 1997, and I asked him, where were you in 1997? And he said he was there at Perkins, And in fact, he was closer to getting out than he is today. And I realized that meant he'd been there for over 20 years. And then I became very curious because, you know, all the patients have committed serious crimes, but hardly any of them stay that length of time. The average stay is around 7 years, I think,
right.
And often a lot less. So he told me that he'd killed his parents, which is, you know, it's a terrible crime. But among schizophrenics who commit murder, killing one's parents is not uncommon. I think there's I've read different estimates, but, you know, at least 300 such murders a year in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's not a lot, but for a crime that's seen as so unusual, it's not uncommon. So many of the other patients in Perkins had also killed their parents or one of their parents. And so I started to learn more about Brian's story and his history and his background. Eventually I realized, you know, I'm always kind of looking out for new subjects to write about, and I realized that Brian's was a very interesting story, and it's a story that doesn't normally get told. It's about true crime, it's about crime, but it's a different part of a true crime narrative that people don't normally get to hear. And I realized that since Brian was so helpful and articulate and ready to give me his, you know, his psychiatric notes and his court records, and I learned from him that those 27 years have actually been in some ways full of drama, even though the day-to-day life in the hospital might be just ordinary bureaucracy and not much going on. Over time, there's been some really fascinating events there. So I decided to write the book, and Brian, you know, gave me all the information about his life, and I interviewed other people who were involved, and yeah, I just wanted to tell that side of the story that doesn't very often get told.
Let's get to the rest of that other part of the story, but let's first go back to the original horrendous crime. Port St. Joe, Florida, February 21st, 1992, and there's a officer, Timothy Hightower. He's at the police headquarters, and a young man walks in, and this is Brian. What does Brian say to this officer? What is the story that he tells them? What does he tell them?
He tells them that he killed his parents and that he was possessed by the devil. And the officers are dubious. They interview him for a while. They Brian thinks that they suspected he was on drugs, or they really didn't seem to believe him, partly because his parents had a vacation home in Florida, although they lived in Maryland, and the police assumed that perhaps the parents were at the vacation home, or that Brian was mistaken, or Brian was confused because he didn't know when he killed them. He thought it was maybe 10 days, 2 weeks. He wasn't sure. He had a very
right.
clear memory of what happened. But he also said that he wasn't sure if he dreamed it or if he imagined it. And so he seemed very, in some ways, very determined and clear. In other ways, very much out of touch. The police in Florida made calls to the police in Maryland. Well, first they called Brian's home, and there was no answer. Then they called the local police in Maryland, where Brian lived, and said that we have a young man down here who says he's killed his parents. Do you have a record of an elderly couple, retired couple, who have been killed? And they said, no, not at all. But they said they would do a wellness check anyway, just in case. They went to the house, and they found that actually Brian was telling the truth. He had killed his parents. He'd shot them both, and then he had immediately stolen the family car and took his dog with him and driven. He intended to drive across the border to Mexico, but he ended up actually, you know, kind of going in circles, and eventually he picked up a hitchhiker, and he was very delusional all this time. But he had a revelation. He was at a campsite in Port St. Joe, Florida for a while, he read the King James Bible. He heard a show on the radio, a religious show, and had this revelation that he had been possessed by the devil and that he needed to turn himself over to the police to be forgiven, which is what he did. And so that's kind of where the story begins.
Police, when they do the wellness check, obviously find, even through the window, the officer can see that there's someone sitting in a chair and obviously dead. What is the condition of his parents in that home found by police at that time in Maryland?
Well, they've been, he shot them, I think it was just over a week earlier. So obviously the bodies are decomposing and in a bad state. But then so is the rest of the house. I mean, I begin the book with a description of the scene that the police find, because the house is really, now I've seen the police photographs, it's really a wreck. There's trash everywhere. It looks like the home of hoarders, and there's just, there's food all over the kitchen. It looks like, it doesn't look lived in, but the parents were living there, and Brian's mother had cancer, breast cancer, and she was using an oxygen tank. The television was on when the police went in. Upstairs, the house was not so messy, but there were really strange signs all over the house that clearly, something had been wrong in this house for a very long time. And there was like writing on a TV guide that said, "Go to hell." There was a strange kind of circle in the floor in the basement. There were a lot of karate trophies in an upstairs bedroom and bullet shells. And they found the box for a sawn-off shotgun. So they were kind of putting the story together as they studied the house and photographed the house and conducted the autopsy, that this was clearly a house where things had not been right for some time. And they were right.
You, in your book, go back and tell the story of Brian Anthony Bechtold and his parents, George and Dorothy. Tell us a little bit about who these people were and tell us how they lived.
The Bechtolds were a family. The parents, George and Dorothy, grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And like many families, there was a history of mental illness in the family, although it wasn't necessarily called mental illness. There was an uncle who wasn't right in the head, and people had different euphemisms for it, but clearly there was a history of mental illness in the family. And the parents married fairly young, and George was doing his PhD in electrical engineering, and Dorothy became a housewife pretty quickly. And it seems that right from the start they were mismatched. It seems that George was very distant and cold and didn't really seem to be interested in his family, or didn't really have an ability to show affection, was a very withdrawn kind of person. And because they were Catholics, they had a number of children in succession. They had four children while George was still finishing his PhD, and they were moving around the country as he worked at the Weapons Center. And then he got a job at Martha Marietta in Orlando, Florida, and that was a big move up in the world for the family. They moved into a more prosperous house, and it seemed like things were really kind of settling down, but the dynamic between the parents, George and Dorothy, was just getting worse and worse, and they became, they weren't the most abusive parents, but they certainly began using the punishing the children, especially George Jr., the older boy, and being very physically hands-on and neglecting them for long periods of time. So they were certainly neglectful and abusive. And then when the family seemed to be falling apart, Dorothy found, she was 42, she found that she was pregnant with Brian. The last thing this family needed was another child. They were ill-prepared to deal with the four children they already had. But for some reason, George did not want his wife to have an abortion, even though she wanted one. And so Brian was more into this, you know, this very, this like hothouse, you know, this terrible situation where he really didn't have a chance right from the start. He was not really welcomed.
Yes. So he, to say he had a dysfunctional family life was to say the least, and with siblings much older than him and a couple of the siblings trying to get out of the house from this dysfunctional family life itself. But there was particular, you talk about George Sr. Being abusive and cruel to his wife and family. But then he had an accident and he quit drinking, and then he was even more aggressive and verbally abusive, wasn't he?
Yeah, and it's interesting because people think, again, like you tell a narrative and someone gives up drinking and they seem to, you know, that's usually the turning point and they'll recover. But in fact, George seems to have been using alcohol to, you know, to help him and to make him feel more affectionate, to help him sleep. And there was 3 years when he was sort of basically drying out from his alcoholism, when he was even colder. And then his wife Dorothy got breast cancer and she's very sick, and he didn't seem to have very much sympathy towards her at all. And so the dynamic of the family descended even further. And yes, I mean, one of the daughters attempted suicide many times. Both of the daughters were in and out of psychiatric hospitals. One ran off to join a cult. They basically did everything they could to get out of this devastatingly abusive family situation. And Brian, for a while, found relief in martial arts. He joined taking martial arts lessons and became very close to his martial arts teacher and made a good friend there at the karate studio. And for a while, it seemed as though that was kind of, he was found a path that was going to be more accepting. But after that, things really went downhill. He dropped out of school. He started using drugs and really he went to college for a while, but then he was on probation for a drug offense, and then his father stopped paying the tuition. So, when it seemed as though things were getting better, things were getting worse. And Brian really didn't know the two older siblings at all. They were, you know, 15 years and 17 years older than him. So they were really far apart. And after the older siblings left home, Brian was still young. He was still a young boy, and he was left at home with these older parents who really had no interest in him and didn't really want him there. So it's unsurprising that his depression became pathological.
Was any religion an element in this? You talk about that he later or soon would say that he was possessed by the devil, but how much was religion an influence, and what religions was he looking at in particular?
Well, his parents were Catholic, and they seem to have pretty consistently gone to church regularly at various times, but the children didn't have to go to church and didn't, you know, unless they wanted to. And for a while, one of Brian's sisters, like I said, she ran away and joined a cult, a kind of strange cult in New York called the Forever Family. And one of the things that the cult members did was perform exorcisms. And Brian remembers getting a cassette tape from his sister, recordings of exorcisms that he was sort of fascinated by, and he remembers sort of playing them again and again and wondering, you know, thinking about the idea that someone could have been possessed by the devil. So the idea was already kind of, you know, floating around in his mind from an early time. But then he also he had a girlfriend who was Iranian, and he didn't convert, but he learned, he gave up eating pork, and he listened to the Quran on audio tape, and, you know, became very interested in religion. But he never actually practiced any religion himself or felt as though he was a Christian until after the crime, when he believed that he'd been told to turn himself in and that he was forgiven. So there was certainly a strong religious element to it. And in fact, Brian has been religious ever since then, although he's learned, that's one of the things he's learned not to talk about in the psychiatric hospital, because it's generally seen as a symptom of a mental illness in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. So the family life is dysfunctional, but does anyone notice his increased, we'll say, departure from sanity? Does anybody notice these changes in Brian? And what are some of the other things? You talked about drug use. I've heard the theory about marijuana and people vulnerable to schizophrenia, and marijuana can exacerbate that. But I especially agree with some of the drugs that he was taking that could alter his sense of reality, which would be PCP. And so he was doing often hard drugs and not just chronically smoking marijuana.
Right. For a while he was. And this is, you know, this is often the pattern in people who have a schizophrenic break. I mean, this is around the age of sort of late teens to early 20s, when a person is already genetically sort of predisposed to schizophrenia anyway. And in Brian's case, it just seemed like it was a loaded gun, really. He was using a lot of marijuana, and also everything he can get, particular strain of PCP called Love Boat that was around in D.C. at the time that he was getting hold of. But that was a short period of time that he was doing that. He had a job delivering pizza, and he was arrested. Coming home from work one day, and the police found some drugs in his car, and his parents sent him to rehab. And then Brian made a decision not, you know, to give up drugs, the same way that his father made a decision to give up drinking. And he didn't do any drugs after that, apart from the medication that he's been prescribed. He hasn't drunk or done any drugs since then. But you're right that Brian was severely neglected. I mean, in other circumstances, if people were paying attention, they would have seen the signs there, but his parents were clearly self-involved, and they had their own problems, very serious problems. Occasionally, he would be sent to a psychiatric ward or put into therapy, but it was always very brief and obviously didn't take the family situation into account. Either that, or people were kind of foxed by the way the family presented themselves, because his father, George, had a PhD. He worked for the government scientist. He presented very well, and a lot of the psychiatrists and therapists were intimidated by him. And so basically, when things started getting very bad, any parents would have noticed. I mean, Brian was doing things like talking on the telephone without dialing a number first. He was sleeping all day and only going out late at night. He had a pair of dogs that he spent almost all of his time with. He believed that people were following him. He constructed a dummy and dressed it in his own clothes and propped it in the window of the house so that his enemies would think that he was home all the time. And then finally, he bought a shotgun and was carrying it around with him, even in the shower. And his parents all the time thought this was, you know, they were kind of bemused by it, according to Brian's sister. They thought that he was kind of paranoid about outsiders and about external enemies, but they didn't seem to think for a moment that they themselves might be at risk. So all the signs seem to have been there from, you know, right from the beginning.
But one of the signs that wasn't there, which, having interviewed quite a few authors about Parasite, is that there was, this obvious resentment. And here, this story doesn't seem to be any buildup of that other than his disappointment. And again, it didn't seem to be, you didn't write it as resentment. It was disappointment that his father didn't pay for tuition after an incident at college. So instead of being able to go back, his father said no. So he went back, lived at home.
I think it was more... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that I think I did a lot of research about parasites, and especially schizophrenic children who kill their parents. And it seems to be that in a lot of cases, the the buildup is slow and gradual, and there's a lot of repression. And so there isn't any overt moment, you know, where the father refuses this or denies this, or the mother, you know, disinherits, or, you know, the parents don't necessarily do anything wrong. And in fact, or at least not overtly at that particular moment. And it's often something very trivial that is that kind of pulls the trigger, as it were. So, an ordinary kind of disagreement, or in this case, Brian was trying to get to sleep and was woken up by his father yelling. And so in some ways, it just seems like the last straw in a situation that has been going on and perhaps seems like it could go on indefinitely. And the crying often takes place when the parents are going about their ordinary business. Like, okay, so father was eating a meal, the mother was watching television. There doesn't seem to be any, you know, a big fight, or it's not a kind of dramatic climax to a story. It's just something that's that might be the dramatic climax in the mind of the child, but not overtly on the surface to anyone else. And I think that's one of the things that distinguishes parricides, where the perpetrator is schizophrenic, from ordinary parricides, I guess.
You talk about that there was no clear trigger that night. So what you just mentioned, that his father was yelling. What was his father yelling about? And then what happened?
Well, Brian, he hadn't been able to sleep, and he'd been staying up, quite sure how long, possibly all week, and trying to sleep, pacing around, you know, getting incredibly frustrated and impatient. And the way that he remembers it, it was like a kind of dream, but he said that he finally managed to fall asleep. And a moment later, he was woken up by his father yelling in the kitchen downstairs, which is, you know, it was early in the morning. His father seems to be yelling while he's having his breakfast. Brian can't, you know, whatever he yelled, it was something completely inconsequential. All Brian remembers is the words, "My brother Walter." And it was like that. It was just like a last straw for Brian. He simply couldn't take it. And when he talked about the event to the police, and he said that it felt like it was predetermined, or like something he was watching on television, or like something that happened in a dream, or like it wasn't him. He wasn't the one doing it. And when he'd, at the end of the murder, he had a moment when he felt that his feet were not touching the ground. So it seems to be a very surreal, delusional experience where absolute extremes of torment, and that's when the psychotic break really occurs.
And just for people listening, he had not been under the influence for drugs for almost 3 years at that point, correct?
That's right. Yeah, he'd given up drugs and had given up drinking. So but he hadn't been on any medications either. So he was purely psychotic.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity, Makita, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. I'm excited about things getting back to normal this summer and looking forward to the beach and barbecues and get-togethers with friends I haven't seen in ages. Playing Best Fiends makes your brain feel refreshed, like a dip in a lake after a hot day in the sun. And once you start playing Best Fiends, you just won't want to stop. I'm on level 85 right now, and I've been making a few new levels every time I get a chance to play. Best Fiends is a super fun matching puzzle game. Time really flies when I'm playing, and it's totally free to download. There are thousands of free puzzles to solve with something new every day. I'm already on level 85, but there's many, many levels to go. Best Fiends' adorable collectible characters keep coming. Best Fiends releases new challenges, characters, and themes all the time, keeping players on their toes. The real fun is when you team up with characters based on their special abilities and gain extra points and items to level up your fiends. Give Best Fiends a try. I know you'll love it too. Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, best fiends. Now, Makita, we talked about that he was in this. He said later he wasn't sure what was real. This happened. This occurred. He took off. He thought he was going to Texas, but wound up in Florida. Then he turned himself in. So what happens with this? You talk in the book about how many, the misconception of how many people will be deemed not criminally responsible or as previously insane, and how many people are even afforded that kind of defense in trials in reality. Tell us what happens after his arrest with him legally in the courts.
Well, he's transported back to Maryland. So as soon as he turns himself in, he's in the custody of the police. And he told me about this transport going back from Florida to Maryland, which really shouldn't have taken that long, but it took, I think, 3 weeks because he was, the courts outsourced to a private transportation company who went, you know, various places, Mississippi and Vermont and various other places. So it was a really long journey, but he was put in custody, and right away his sisters got him a lawyer, and right away the lawyer realized that Brian was clearly insane. He told me, and Brian was also seen by a state forensic psychiatrist who also determined that he was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, and so because of that a defense psychiatrist wasn't even called in. So with the family history and Brian's own psychological history and his actions and the record of his actions and words after the crime, it seemed very clear to everyone that he was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia and had been for some time, and he was undiagnosed, unmedicated, and this is not as common as people seem to think, and it's certainly not an easy way out. In fact, I don't know what the statistic is now, but when I was writing the book, it was less than 1% of cases that people are found not criminally responsible, and which is the Maryland version of criminally insane. And in those cases, 26% have previous psychiatric history. So it's very rare and probably impossible for someone to suddenly decide, well, I'll use this insanity defense as a get-out-of-jail-free card and have a kind of cushy time in a hospital rather than going to prison. But in Brian's case, it was very clear from the start that he was mentally ill, and he was sent to Clifton Perkins, which is Maryland's maximum security, forensic maximum security hospital, now presumably for treatment until he was well enough to. Well, he actually didn't go to court. He waived his right to trial because he was found incompetent to stand trial. So he began the long process of what should have been a journey to recovery, and to 1992, and now it's 2021, and Brian is still in Perkins. He's been there 27 years, and in the book I explain the long journey that he's taken through the hospital. In fact, he's been there longer than most doctors and many of the other patients now. And just the difficulties, the setbacks, the medication, the different doctors, the different psychiatrists, the frustration. Brian believes, and I'll give him credit for this, it makes sense to me, that he was extremely mentally ill at the time he killed his parents and for a long time before that and sometime afterwards. But he was restored to sanity not too long after. Brian believes it was when he turned himself in. He had a revelation, a religious revelation, and turned himself in. And he still believes that that's what cured him. He certainly hasn't been dangerous or paranoid or sort of pathologically ill for the last, I would say, for a long time, for many years. But he's still at the hospital. And that's what fascinated me about his story, because it's been he calls it, it's like, he describes it as playing musical chairs with the invisible man, that having to go through all these hoops and being blindfolded and not knowing what to say, the language keeps changing, the hospital jargon keeps changing, the doctors keep changing. He's been so desperate at times that he actually decided that he would prefer to be in prison or dead rather than at the hospital. And that was when he escaped. He took a hostage and escaped, hoping that either he'd be shot by the police and killed, which would be preferable, or that he would be sent to prison, which would be preferable. And he was actually shot and returned to Perkins. I don't think Brian's is a typical case, but nor do I think it's a unique case. And I wanted to draw attention to the plight of people like Brian who are kept in psychiatric hospitals indefinitely. And there are other people as well as Brian who told me that they would prefer to be in prison. And in fact, one patient in the hospital told me about a crime he committed. He attacked a nurse and was sent to prison and wanted to stay there, petitioned the court to allow him to stay there. And there are a number of reasons for this. One of them, I think, is that there's more dignity. They feel there's more dignity in prison, that you're not constantly being scrutinized, that every action and word isn't seen as a symptom of something. You're seen as a free agent who makes choices and makes decisions like everyone else, not someone who's acting symptoms of a disease, but also because there's a determinate time that you're going to be there, even if it's life, it's better than not knowing. So if you get 30 years or 40 years in prison, at least there's an end to it. And for Brian and people in his situation, there's no end to it. And there seems to be no way out. And yet this hope is constantly deferred because theoretically, he could walk out tomorrow if the doctors decided he was cured. So it's this terrible limbo where you're not a criminal, you're not criminally responsible, but then you're not allowed to leave the hospital and you don't seem to be ill, but you're often medicated against your will. You're not violent, but because you've committed an act of violence in the past, it's assumed that you're going to commit an act of violence again. And there are all these kind of double binds that people get trapped in. And I think people have a misconception about what it's like to be in this kind of psychiatric hospital. I think people think it's either like one of those dungeons that Hannibal Lecter's in Silence of the Lambs, mm-hmm. where everyone's, right. Completely crazy and straitjackets, or they think it's kind of easy and cushy and you get great food and all you have to do is lie on a couch and talk to the doctor now and then, and it's an easy way out. But in fact, mm-hmm. it's this kind of, in Brian's experience at least, it's this limbo where, he's like neither one place or another, and it's really a sort of lost world, really, that people don't hear about very much.
You talk about how it is that no matter what, they go through the process of maximum security, and then their behavior is judged, and then they get a reassessment, evaluation, and then they go to medium security, more privileges and benefit to being in medium security. Again, your behavior is one of the conditions, the main condition. And then to minimum security, and from minimum security, the doctors and people will talk about that will be the eventual pathway to release, to discharge from this hospital. But you explain that no matter how optimistic Brian got and with progress and getting through those security requirements from, maximum to minimum, that there was ways that they assessed him as still being not able to ever get near this discharge, where this led to incredible frustration and highly contributed to this escape, obviously. Some of the things that you talk about being used in the psychiatrist to be able to deny them further progress in these security ratings is the idea of religion and the idea of that Brian did not want to take any of the antipsychotic drugs. So tell us how those two things contributed to him not making the progress that he would have liked.
Right. I mean, you think that you get to minimum security, and then the next step is, housing in the community or community facility or, conditional release. But in fact, as Brian learned, you can go back down the track again, back down to maximum. And he's been up and down that track many, many times. And, two of the things that were held against him, first of all, at first when he was at the hospital, there was no pressure to, or you could choose not to take medication. It was up to you, although you were strongly encouraged to do so if the psychiatrist felt that it was appropriate. And Brian was strongly encouraged to go on antipsychotics, which most of the other patients were on. He didn't see that he needed them. He saw the way that patients were slumped in front of the television. The drugs made other patients incontinent and impotent, and he didn't want to be in that situation. And eventually that was held against him. The only way to progress out of the hospital was to be directable, meaning you do what you're told and you follow the rules. And if the rules are you have to be on antipsychotics, then eventually he realized that that's what he had to do. And, he talks about a period of years when he said, I slept in a chair from 2002 to 2005 or something, these missing years when he was on such a heavy dose of antipsychotics that he remembers nothing of those years. He was sleeping for years, and he was impotent. He was incontinent. I think anyone can understand why one would resist you going on medication. And so he had an understanding, sympathetic doctor who gradually allowed him to come off medication. He was making progress. That doctor left. Another doctor came who wanted him to be on medication, and he was back at the beginning again. So it was these are things that have contributed to him acting out, attempting to escape, and then later on attacking a social worker. But another thing that was held against him was his religion. We don't talk about it very much, but Brian is religious, and he believes that he was saved. But he found that whenever he talked about that in front of his doctors, because he didn't belong to any particular church, because he'd come to his own understanding of the Bible from reading it, that was seen as religiosity, a side effect of schizophrenia, and it was held against him, and it was seen as a sign of his mental illness, not a sign that he was interested in the Bible or in religion, just as it would be for someone on the outside. And as he pointed out to me, there are people who have all kinds of what we might think of as bizarre religious beliefs. There are people who believe in snake handling and voodoo. And as long as you're part of an established church, it's acceptable. But because Brian wasn't part of an established church, he'd just come to these decisions on his own. It was seen as a symptom of his pathology. So eventually he stopped talking about it. And then that was used against him. The doctor said that he was hiding his illness by not talking about religion. So he really couldn't win, and I really sympathize with his frustration. I mean, the idea that everything that you do could be used against you if you're not mentally ill already, I think that could drive you that way.
In this time period, who did he have contact with? Who was his support system? I hate to use that word because that's the word they used the psychiatric department. But what were the people there that were still behind them? What siblings were still there? What friends were still in contact other than yourself?
Yeah, originally because he was so much younger than his siblings, he didn't really have much contact with his older siblings. And if someone killed their parents, it's a very difficult time for the family, but two of his sisters stood by him and were very encouraging and supportive and helped him get a lawyer and helped him get diagnosed. And one of those sisters eventually moved out of state and has since passed away. The other sister was supportive of Brian for a long time, but she moved to a different state too. He was in touch with his friend from the karate center, and his karate teacher, but, you know, 27 years, people die, they move away, they have families of their own, and Brian is kind of left. He has contact with his sister, who's helped him out and has offered to take him into a home should he be released, so he does have contact on the outside world, and he does have support, and I've been supportive to him, and he has former patients who are friends of his too, who help him out, but after being in hospital for so long and being away from the community for so long, being away from his family and having caused this great division in his family, and you know, the hospital is kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's difficult to get to. It's the visiting hours are odd. It's difficult for people to visit. So over time, he's really lost that network that he would have originally had. And that too is held against him now because he doesn't have a strong support network on the outside. Then that's seen as another factor against, risk factor for him causing more violence when he if he ever leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, you know, it's really like a catch-22 in so many situations.
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now let's talk about February 10th, 2014. His struggle, you chronicle that there are so many times when he's down, he's depressed, he's in the fog. You say he's trying to fight the fog of these antipsychotic drugs that he just doesn't want to have in his system, period. And there's times when he works out and feels stronger and feels mentally more able. And now this February 10th, 2014 is a guardianship hearing. How does he get to this point? And tell us what this is and what it represents for him.
Well, there were two times that Brian has been to court to defend his case in front of a jury. And the guardianship, this one in 2014 was actually his a release hearing. I think that the guardianship was an earlier hearing when he had cancer, and he decided that he didn't want to be treated for cancer. He wanted to be allowed to die. He was so unhappy. He was so frustrated. He realized it's impossible to commit suicide in this hospital. Everything is suicide-proof. He thought this was a way out. It was not going to be an easy death, but this is finally a way out. So he said that he didn't want to be treated for his cancer. Well, the hospital wouldn't allow that. They felt that he was not capable of making that decision for himself, and they insisted that the hospital itself became his guardian, and to do that they had to have a hearing in court. And Brian defended himself. He acted as his own attorney, and I've heard the transcript. I've listened to the transcript. He did a really fantastic job. He argued his case very articulately. He tried to show that he was in his right mind. He was rational. He knew what cancer was. He knew what was in store for him. He understood patients of it. He had, you know, he'd read up on it. But there was a technicality, and the judge, basically, it was a hung jury, and then after that, the judge decided for the hospital. And it seems to be that the judiciary will defer to the psychiatrist in all cases, because even if someone presents really well, like Brian, I think that most judges, and perhaps most people, would think, well, this guy seems fine, he seems articulate, he seems intelligent, but I don't know, I'm not a specialist. It's the psychiatrist, they really know. They know what's going on under the surface. And I think that's really wrong. I think, you know, the point of a jury trial is that you judge for yourself. And if someone appears to understand what's going on, they haven't caused violence for many, many years, if they seem intelligent and rational, then I don't think judge nor jury should defer to the judgment of psychiatrists. But that's what happens in both cases.
It was fascinating, and that unlike a criminal court, Brian was afforded less rights, as far as I can see, in terms of This was a hung trial. It was a mistrial, but the judge ruled in favor of the hospital. It's like the tie goes to the hospital. I'd never heard of that before. So that was unusual. But also that it's disturbing in as much as that no matter what he said and how articulate he was to defend himself, and he was probably correct in that he was better prepared having knowledge of his charts and his diagnosis than a lawyer might be prepared to present the same argument. But the prosecution presented psychiatric witnesses that use things like antisocial personality disorder, which basically, as you write, would label him a psychopath and then hence incurable no matter what.
Right. And I think, you know, everyone advises you not to act as your own attorney, but I think in Brian's case, he did the right thing. Firstly, because, yes, he did know it was about his case and about his sanity and his stability. And if he was just sitting there with his lawyer doing all the work, the jury wouldn't get a real sense of him and who he was and how intelligent he was and how stable he was. And that's what he wanted to show to the jury. So I think he did the right thing in representing himself. And he really did a good job of it. And he really, I mean, the testimony from the psychiatrist, they had a lot of psychiatrists who'd never met Brian but had been brought in to test. And yes, because his risk factor was high, meaning that, you know, he'd committed a violent crime, that he'd had drug use when he was younger, a number of other things that he can't possibly change, he can't do anything about, it turns out that his risk of reoffending is high. There's nothing he can do about that. He can't go back and change his childhood. He can't go back and change what happened to him. Nothing's going to change that. So he's kind of trapped in the situation where the psychiatry can simply be used against him. And it's kind of baffling to me why they won't give him a break. And I think it's because he's struggled. He's been driven to extremes. He has tried to escape. He has attacked people. And to me, it's just behaving the way that anyone in that situation would behave. It seems like false violence towards others and not an example of his pathology. But I think everyone's afraid that if he's released and commits another crime, then it's on them. Nobody wants to be responsible. And I understand that fear. I mean, that happens with a lot of people who are mentally ill, and there are problems with, you know, people not getting support in the community. But I think each case is different, and I don't think Brian is one of those people. I think he's just trapped. He's kind of trapped in this, like I said, in this horrible limbo.
It was disturbing a little bit because, unlike a criminal case, the prosecutor released information about the murder of his parents because, again, he's in this no-win situation where no matter what, there's that past
murderous
behavior or the escape. If he's going to leak that to this jury that he's killed his family,
And in fact, the judge told them, the jury, that they could only use information that came out in the trial. They weren't supposed to use any other information at all. And at one point, a doctor says that, the psychiatrist says that Brian has a problem with breaking the rules. And Brian hasn't broken rules for a long time. So he said, well, give me an example of breaking the rules. And she said, well, murdering your parents is an example of breaking the rules. Now, that should have been an objection, a mistrial right there. But it was simply overlooked. So, and even then, it seemed like most of the jury were on his side. I think there was one or two holdouts, and then again, it was a hung jury, and again, the judge decided against him.
It's interesting, too, despite his progress with psychiatrists and with his behavior, to the point where he was actually released for, you say, 14 different 2-hour passes without incident, he always thought that these things were going to be accumulated in his favor to demonstrate his lack of violent tendencies, or did it ensure his safe release in the community? But that was not to be, was it?
No, and the 14 visits outside the hospital were a really long time ago. I mean, I think they were, that was like before the year 2000, so you know, 20 years ago. And he thought at that time, you know, he's getting close to release. He's been allowed out in the community safely, and yet after the escape attempt, it seemed like nothing could go his way. And he'd been in there so long that, you know, things would be improving, then there'd be another change of regime, another CEO or another clinical director, or a different, you know, different medications would come in, or a different kind of psychiatric fashions would, or even diagnosis. I mean, paranoid schizophrenia isn't even a diagnosis anymore. And it seemed as though every time he was making progress, there'd be some systemic change that meant that he was like right back at the beginning again, even down to things like the sort of language that you have to use to get the doors to open. And because he's maintained his dignity, because he has no ties to the community, and because he has trouble jumping through hoops just for the sake of it, I think it's all counted against him. And, you know, I agree that he'd committed a terrible crime, but if we're going to say that a person is not responsible for the crime, then we also have to treat them like someone who's not responsible instead of punishing them, which is what's happening with Brian.
Yes, it's it's very interesting to think that he escaped after. It wasn't that things were going swimmingly, and then it was after setback, and he thought his situation was futile. To be fair, I think he felt it was futile, and I don't think that he was deluded in that thinking at that point when he escaped and really set himself back even further. But he was in that particular situation. It wasn't like he wasn't at wit's end at that time when he contemplated that.
Right. And I think it was a rational decision. I think it's very hard to know what we would do in those circumstances, but I can imagine behaving like that. I don't think it's a symptom of mental illness that you become so hopeless and frustrated that you're willing to risk your life to get out of there.
Yeah, it was fascinating that he thought prison would be a much better deal, and then he went to those lengths, and they returned him right back to Perkins once again and went back to maximum security. And as you write, went right back to admissions. And if he thought it was bad before, it was much worse after, taking hostages and creating all the trouble he did for everybody at that hospital, didn't he?
Right, yeah. I mean, he thought, well, they couldn't do anything. There's nothing else they could do to him. You know, the worst comes to the worst, he'll get sent back to Perkins again, and he won't be any worse off. Well, he did get sent back to Perkins, and he was worse off because there was this, now he has this legacy of acting out violent behavior, and he's put in restraints, he's refused privileges, and all kinds of things about him that he didn't anticipate. So things can always get worse. I mean, when I was asking him a lot about this book, whether, you know, whether he thought it would help him or hurt him, I really didn't want to, you know, to do anything that would hurt his case. And he said, there's nothing they can do. You know, they've done everything they can. There's nothing they can do to me that they haven't already done. And I'm hoping that's the case. I'm hoping this will help him and not be used against him in any way.
Well, I wouldn't count on that. But, I mean, again, he seems to be just in a place where they can't do much more. And he has been subjected to everything that they had given to him. Luckily, he had the option not to, as one doctor recommended, that he be given shock treatment. And he flatly refused that. So it's an incredible story of his plight in the, you know, it seemed, too, that this hearing seemed very much like a parole hearing. It very much like it depended on the compliance. It would depend, you write about so many people that were released from this hospital that maybe even were, well, not maybe, were still experiencing symptoms of their diagnosed mental illness, and yet they were released because they were compliant. So there
right.
was a
compliance
lot to...
Compliance is very, very important. Yeah. Yeah, it's a key word, compliance. It sort of means whatever they want it to mean, but it's certainly one of the magic words that will get the door to open.
Before I let you go, what is the situation with Brian now in terms of, I know what, not going to be getting released anytime soon, but what is the current situation for him? How's he doing?
Well, he's on a decent ward. I think it's a minimum security, and he has, COVID was a big problem because they were locked down for a really long time, and they still can't have visits, but they can have, like, Skype visits. And things are not so bad. Like, he's in a situation where he can have coffee, he would be able to have visits if they were still allowing visits. So and it's been so long since his last court date that he's thinking about, you know, going if he's not released soon or if things aren't progressing, he might have the opportunity to go back to court again, and that's always a possibility. But you know, I think he's this writing the book and has been a really interesting experience for me and for him. So it's at least a little bit of a difference in his life, in this very tedious life.
I want to thank you so much, Makita, for coming and talking about a couple found slain after a family murder. I know that you have written other books for those people that would like to check out your other true crime books and your unique perspective with those. There's an Amazon page, but also you have a website. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have a website. It's just my name, MakitaBrotman.com, and there's links to all my books. And I am interested in true crime. I have a book about an unexplained death that came out a couple of years ago, a book about my work in a maximum security prison. So it is true crime, but it's a kind of different take on true crime than perhaps people are used to. But, yeah, everything can be found there, more information about me and my work and so on. Well, thank you for having me, Dan. It was very interesting to talk to you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. It's been amazing. Thank you so much. Couple found slain after a family murder, Makita Brotman. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thanks.
Good night.